This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with a new book that tells a very interesting story about a part of North Dakota that has changed considerably since the time of the start of the book. It's about five generations of Jewish families in South Central North Dakota and frankly in parts of South Dakota as well. And it's told by Rebecca Bender. She is the co-author of Still. It's a combination biography and memoir that you wrote with your father before he passed away. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How did you and your father come to write the book?
Well, initially, my dad had started writing a book about his memories. And his book was entitled From the Prairies to the Beaches. And I was the lucky typist, and I was also able to probe his recollections a little more to get more details. But unfortunately, he passed away in 2006, but thankfully he finished his book. And it wasn't until approximately 2013 when my son, who was then 15, was with me visiting the Ashley Jewish Homesteader Cemetery for the second time, that he said to me, "Mom, I really don't know that much about our farming ancestors." And I realized that I knew some things, but I wanted to know more. And I thought, if my son has questions, maybe other people who happen by the cemetery may also have questions. So that day, I secretly made had a thought that I would try to get this property on the National Register of Historic Places. And I was told by very kind people, "That's a lovely pipe dream." But I can tell you that after lots of work and lots of research, it actually is on the National Register now. And I discovered so much interesting information thanks to both the information in my dad's book, but also my grandfather had writings. I discovered writings from my great-grandparents. But even more than that, I discovered about the whole Ashley Jewish homesteading community, because there were family histories that had been gathered by a former resident of Fargo named Toba Geller. And she unfortunately had passed away before she wrote the book she wanted to, called Jews of North Dakota. But I was the lucky recipient of all of these wonderful family histories. And when I saw all that was there, I thought, this has to be a book.
Well, the book is Still. It's about five generations of North Dakotans. Today is the release date for the book. It's published by the North Dakota State University Press, so a special day for you. Thanks for being with us, Rebecca.
Yes.
Tell us about your dad.
Well, my dad grew up in Eureka, South Dakota, but had a great sense of respect for previous generations, shared that feeling of respect with my sister and myself. And I like to think that that's been passed on in the genes and that it goes to my son and will someday go to his children.
Your son, Lincoln, is that his
yes,
name?
Yes, okay. His name is Lincoln. And my dad also had a great appreciation for America. You can imagine hearing stories growing up about pogroms that killed his father's two brothers, and about the rights that were lacking to Jewish people in Odessa and in the Pale of Settlement generally, that they were so thankful to be living in America where they were free to practice their religion, pursue the occupation that they were interested in. And he was a great guy, and I don't want to spoil too much of what happens later in the book. I'll just suffice it to say that he ended up being the first volunteer from McPherson County, South Dakota, for World War II.
Wow. Well, this story you're telling of these pogroms, that's been dramatized. Fiddler on the Roof, the big musical that became a movie too, sort of tells this story in a lyrical fashion and sort of a sweet way, but it was a very tough story. And the Germans from Russia sort of had a similar experience themselves.
That's very true. And to have the writings actually from my grandfather's sister and her husband about what it was like as being part of watch groups in Odessa, not knowing when the Cossacks would come or when the Tsar's secret police would come, and knowing that if they were discovered with any weapons, of course, to defend themselves, that would be the end of all of them.
Well, when we think of Jewish settlement in the United States, we think of Brooklyn, we think of New York, Queens, and, you know, the metropolitan areas. How is it that the Bender family gets to the Dakotas?
Well, you are so right, because actually it's been found that over 70% of Jewish immigrants stayed in on the East Coast. So what I felt was, as soon as they decided to take trains west, they were already pioneers before they even went onto the land to become farmers. But what happened was, I think there was initially a hope when they were in Odessa that things would change. With each of the four czars that are mentioned in the books, they keep and still, they kept hoping that conditions would improve.
So they could go back?
Well, no, I mean when they were in Russia.
Oh, gotcha.
Before they immigrated.
Yeah.
No. Once they got out, they were so thankful to be out. One of my favorite quotes from my grandpa Joe was, when people say, oh, you must miss your homeland, he would always say, that's not my homeland. America's my homeland. How could anyone love a country that treats its citizens that way?
Mm-hmm.
So it was initially they were thinking things would improve. But once their two sons were killed, Kiva and Rebecca were my great-grandparents, and you can tell I'm named after my great-grandmother, Rebecca. Once their two sons were killed, the story is that my great-grandfather said, enough. And they had two offers in the United States from family members who had already relocated. One was in Ashley, North Dakota, where my great-grandmother's sister had married a fellow who ran the general store in Ashley. His name was Israel Arbach, and he ran what the German Russians in the community called the Israel store.
Okay.
And so that was one offer they had. The other offer was some family members, the Margolins, had settled in New York City, and they owned a restaurant by this point. And they ended up, Kiva Bender, my great-grandfather, said, if we could farm the land, that would be the best. We'd be our own boss. We'd be independent. We'd be helping the community. And it's what one of the rights that Jews had been denied in Russia by the May laws in 1881, that they could not own land for farming or other reasons. So that the big pull was to go to the Arbachs, supported by them. They helped pay for their way, as well as the Margolins actually helped pay for their way too. And they ended up taking the train. They could not all go at the same time, because there weren't enough funds to do that, but they eventually all made it, stopped in Eureka, and moved on to Ashley in an ox cart, and became farmers when they had never ridden horses before.
Eureka, South Dakota, close to Ashley, not
right,
too far away.
Right.
So you're living in what we now call the Sauerkraut Triangle, a concentration of Germans from Russia, and it seems to me that it's sort of like you've transplanted a piece of Odessa to North Dakota, because even though your neighbors weren't Jewish, they probably spoke a similar language and probably kind of knew generally each other.
Yes, that is so correct. And actually, in my research, I ran across a woman whose name is Dr. Ahrens, and she had written a book about the German Russians as well and their relationships with their Jewish neighbors. And she was the first person who I saw who was coming to sort of the same conclusion I had, which was exactly as you say, the German Russians and the Jews were comfortable with each other as neighbors in Odessa region in southern Russia. And then they came here, they were still comfortable with each other. It's like, why would that change? Though the Jews could not own land in Russia, many times they were brokers of the grain that the German Russians were growing. So they had developed that relationship of trust, and once they came here, that continued. And the book details numerous stories about the kindnesses back and forth that took place between the Jews and their neighbors, the German Russians. And it's really, you and I are familiar with the Rachel Kaloff story. And just briefly, the difference between the situation and the experience of these homesteaders in North Dakota and South Dakota and poor Rachel's situation was that this, I believe, is a story of community that really worked.
Now, the book also includes your childhood growing up in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And St. Louis Park, Minnesota, Minnesota and lots of places in this country had, if not laws, sort of unwritten rules about where certain people could live. And Minneapolis in the early 20th century and frankly up to the middle of the 20th century was a tough place for people of color or ethnic Jews. So St. Louis Park became sort of a haven, didn't it?
You are very correct. And there was a very much higher than typical percentage of Jewish people living in St. Louis Park. So there were kosher restaurants. There were delicatessens.
The Lincoln Deli is famous.
Yes, yes. And yes, so it was a very different experience from what was had been the history of Minneapolis that I believe in the 1950s there was a writer who discussed the fact that Minneapolis he considered to be the anti-Semitic capital of the United States. I know when my parents got married, they were not able to join AAA in Minneapolis because they would not allow in Jewish members, whereas in St. Paul, they could be members. And actually, their honeymoon triptych was from the St. Paul AAA, not the Minneapolis one.
So the diaspora continued when you moved to the Dakotas. There really isn't much of a presence left in the sauerkraut triangle of those original Jewish settlers.
That's true. Actually, the most recent research that I've seen shows there are approximately 400 people in all of the state of North Dakota who consider themselves Jewish. And the same for South Dakota, around 400. Whereas if you look at the end of the 1800s, we're at about 1,800 Jewish people in each state. And, of course, in the 1910 period, there were around 2,500, I believe. So definitely the numbers have dwindled. And that gets right into one of my goals for the book, which was to not only educate people about this group of pioneers that happened to be my family, but also to educate people about the faith generally, the challenges in my family that were faced, some overt, some less than overt challenges over the course of 150 years.
Well, we have a regular personality on Main Street. His name is Tom Easer, and he's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. He's written a new book called Pacing Dakota, which is based on his Plainsfolk essays, which he recites for us here on our show. And he reminds us that this period you're talking about, North Dakota was arguably the most diverse state in the United States. And frankly, we've had a Dakota Date book on the air that reminds us that in Ross, North Dakota, which is probably no longer existent now, the first mosque in the United States was established late in the 19th century by some Lebanese immigrants. So this is important history you are reliving for us today.
Well, and thank you for mentioning Tom Easern, because I must tell you, he is the reason, along with my first cousin, who is an author, that I sent my manuscript to NDSU Press.
Well, his wife, Suzanne Kelly, is the editor of the press.
Yes, and I have read Pacing Dakota, which is a wonderful book, and it also really hit home with me because it involves his spending time in the archives and finding hidden gems. And I feel like that's exactly what I did looking at written materials, though about a slightly different subject.
So your father, Kenneth, who passed away in 2006, sort of planted the seed here. But you were probably exploring this history in some depth after he passed away. So tell us about a gem or two that you came across.
Okay. Well, I feel like the first surprise to me And again, not wanting to give away too much of the twists and turns in the book. But the first surprise to me was learning that my great-grandfather had actually formed the first Ashley Jewish congregation, the first synagogue. But what was interesting, especially about this to me, this was in 1908. He had arrived in 1906, not speaking any English, but he submitted a notice of the congregation to the Jewish Publication Society's Jewish Yearbook in Philadelphia in 1908. This was at a time they had no synagogue, they had no rabbi, but it was a congregation. And they would meet a lot of times in the Bender Barn, and he had a Torah, that's the five books of Moses that they had borrowed from Minneapolis, and they would travel from place to place to different homesteaders' homes to recite the prayers. Particularly, there's a prayer that it's considered a mitzvah, a good deed after a parent has passed away, to say a prayer called the Mourner's Kaddish, the mourner's prayer, but you need 10 people to say the prayer. And the story that we believe and our belief is that when you say the prayer, the person who has passed away rises higher in heaven. So it's considered very important, but without the 10 people, it doesn't apparently get up there where it's supposed to. So it was interesting that they on horseback would form what they call minions, this group of 10 people. So I enjoyed hearing those stories about my great-grandfather's direct involvement with the congregation. I also, when I mentioned Dr. Ahrens, who had written about German Russians and their relationships also with the Jewish community, to my great shock, I found my grandfather's name in her book. And of all things, I learned that her grandfather had come a little late to the party, didn't have money, so it was past the homesteading years. He didn't have money to purchase land. He went to visit Joe Bender, who at that time was running the Bender's Farmer's Cash Store in Eureka with his wife Mary. And on a handshake, having never met each other before, my grandfather lent him money for his first farm.
The good old days. Well, you mentioned the Ashley Jewish Homesteader Cemetery is now on the National Register.
Yes, it is.
And there is also some descriptive plaques there to basically inform people who stop by the important history that you have in your book. The book is called Still, and Rebecca Bender calls herself the co-author with her father, the late Kenneth Bender. And it's a very interesting story, one that is probably significant in terms of the fact that it's largely unknown, I think, to a lot of people in the state. And this is published out today by the North Dakota State University Press. Rebecca, thank you for being with us today on Main Street.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, the aforementioned Tom Ezern with a Plainsfolk essay.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years. But I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. History is as diverse and interesting as the humans who make it. Tom Ezern studies and teaches history, and in his Plain Folks essays each week on Main Street, he shares fascinating nuggets of history mined from the northern plains or plucked from the heavens above. Today his essay is titled, Fires of Hope.
This is not an attempt to rekindle an old controversy, but in my opinion, Our state's flagship university missed an opportunity when, a few years ago, it selected a new nickname for its sports teams. It seems to me the selection process was crippled by lingering commitment to the previous objectionable nickname. The result was Fighting Hawks, which is getting some traction, but is, well, uninspired. The selectors gave short shrift to a proposed nickname that would have been much more inspirational: Sundogs. There is a name that is grounded in the prairies and lifts our eyes to the skies. I'm talking to prairie people in the dead of winter to boot, and so I don't have to explain what a sundog is. But before I explore the sundog in regional culture, I'll be a spoilsport and define it in semi-scientific terms. More formally known as a perihelion, plural perihelia, meaning beside the sun, sundogs are refractions of light through ice crystals in the atmosphere. They commonly appear 22 degrees on either side of the sun, reddish on the side nearer the sun, bluish on the other. On striking occasions, they arc around to join in a halo. On a particularly lucky day, you may see double sundogs, with the second set at 46 degrees. Sundogs can occur any time of year, but they are most common and, I think, most welcome during the coldest stretches of winter. 19th century settlers in Dakota Territory described the dogs of the sun and ascribed common sense meaning to them. Observe the Bismarck Tribune on the 26th of March, 1880. An unusual atmospheric phenomenon was noticed Monday about 5 p.m., consisting of brilliant sundogs on each side of the sun, on a line drawn parallel to it and the horizon, which above the sun was a crescent describing an arc of about 30 degrees with all the colors of the rainbow. Two other crescents similar to the first and each side of it were yet higher up in the heavens. The outer rims of the crescents turned toward each other, showing three distinct arcs, a triple sundog. The Emmons County Record of the 15th of February, 1895, published a nice description of a double sundog, while others discussed the meaning of the recurring phenomenon. Most concurred that it forebode extreme cold. The editor of the Cooperstown Courier in 1884 acknowledged the general belief that sundogs were weather-wise indicative of cold snaps, while others think they denote simply heliocaninity. You have to think about that a minute. Here is another way of looking at the question. My friend Dakota Goodhouse says, "Long ago, a man went out to pray when the cold gray winter seemed to linger too long. The constant bleak gray days began to affect the people's dreams. He came back and instructed the camp to select two groups of youth to go out east of camp and build two fires, then to return. Everyone came together in the center of camp and prayed. The sun broke through the clouds, and as it rose into the sky, the two fires rose into the sky with it. For the Hunkpapa, the sundog is a promise of hope and light." The Hunkpapa call this fiery promise the Wiyachite, meaning the sun makes himself a campfire. I like this story better. The sundog looms over a frigid landscape, but the Wiyachite lightens us with hope.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll have a report from Harvest Public Media about a weed killer that can also damage crops. Sue Balcom will join us for another Main Street Eats. Today she'll talk about produce that's available in late winter. And we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A bill designed to stop people from holding cell phones while they're behind the wheel could be on the floor of the Minnesota House and Senate this month. Governor Tim Walz has pledged his support. But Republican Representative Brian Johnson of Cambridge says he worries about any cell phone crackdown disproportionately affecting people of lesser means who drive older cars.
Who's going to get the citations? Because they don't have the capability to have Bluetooth or One Touch. It's a middle to low income.
DFL Representative Frank Hornstein says people with cars that do not have the modern technology can retrofit their vehicles at a fairly low cost. The House has killed the bill that would make not buckling up a mandatory offense. Right now, it's a secondary offense in that you have to be pulled over for another offense before you could be cited for not wearing your seatbelt. Opponents say North Dakota already has a high rate of buckling up, and they argued it's a matter of personal responsibility. Catherine Republican Representative Daniel Johnston.
At its core, the assertion is that we are the property of the state, and it's as if we are to walk around with a government sign on our back that declares, "Do not mutilate." You and I know that we are indeed not the government's property. This is a personal accountability issue, and it's also an education issue.
But Grand Forks Republican Representative Mark Owens told the House this is a matter of safety and injury prevention.
This is about safety, and it does affect other people in other cars. This is a proactive approach, the proactive approach to injury prevention.
The bill failed on a 54-38 vote. And more snow is in the forecast for southern North Dakota. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm watch for southern North Dakota Friday night into Sunday morning. Alex Edwards is with the National Weather Service in Bismarck.
We're looking at the highest amounts in the southern tier of counties, possibly up to 10 inches in counties along the southern border, and then dropping off a little bit as you get near I-94. We're looking at 5 to 7 inches.
Winds are expected to pick up on Saturday.
The snow will probably be a little heavier and wetter this go around, so we're not quite seeing the widespread areas of blowing snow that we might have earlier in the winter. But if there's snow falling and the wind is picking up pretty good Saturday afternoon, then that'll certainly cause some visibility issues.
Edwards says the Weather Service is watching another storm that might hit the state next week, but he says it's too far out to determine what the track of that storm will be. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On this week's Legislative Review, Fargo Republican Representative Shannon Roars-Jones will talk about Sunday opening, changes in higher education governance, and the future of her bill to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. Legislative Review is heard Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Dicamba's job is to kill weeds, and it does that job well. But it was also blamed for damaging 1 million acres of soybeans in the U.S. last year. As Harvest Public Media's Jonathan Aull reports, planting season is just weeks away, and produce farmers are wondering whether dicamba poses a danger for their fruits and vegetables.
Pigweed thrives here in southeastern Missouri, the area called the boot heel. It's a pervasive and strong plant that does major damage to crops. Tommy Riley farms 4,000 acres of cotton and soybeans in the area. He says for years, the only fix was spraying a lot of chemicals right after planting, and that had limited results.
You'll see the beans suffer. The weeds will suffer worse, but you'll also see the beans suffer at the same time. And in the extend system, you know, you just kill the weeds and the beans keep flourishing.
The Extend system is a dicamba-resistant soybean sold by Bayer. In 2018, farmers sprayed dicamba over 50 million acres of soybeans and cotton. Riley says it's made a huge difference for his farm and his bottom line.
It's the best system out there that works. Our yields are great. Our fields are clean.
Riley's success story is cold comfort to Andrew Joyce.
We'd have customers that, you know, we'd from 8 o'clock in the morning to probably 8, 9 o'clock at night.
Joyce is standing outside his shuttered produce stand right off the highway in Malden, also in the boot heel of Missouri. He's reminiscing about the customers coming to get fresh tomatoes, okra, and peppers he grew on his 3-acre farm. Reminiscing because his produce was so damaged by dicamba that drifted from nearby soybean fields that he lost money. He won't farm this summer.
I like making things grow and everything. I used to be pretty good at it. I stood a chance to, but now with with the chemical drift, you just don't stand a chance to grow anything anymore.
And that's where the dicamba battle stands. Row crop farmers in Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and Arkansas are still using dicamba despite the issues. But specialty crop farmers are still at risk. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency approved dicamba use for 2 more years, but enforcing its proper use is largely up to the states. Sammy Jo Freeman is a spokesperson for the Missouri Department of Agriculture. She says the department investigates all complaints, but there's a limit to what they can do to help the farmers who were hurt by dicamba drift.
So we do a full investigation and we can apply civil penalties in the case that we find evidence to support it.
But those fines don't go to the farmer who was hurt.
They would have to pursue any repayment to make themselves whole through civil court.
That's why Joyce joined more than 1,000 other farmers in a class action lawsuit against Bayer, which may be their only recourse for some kind of compensation for their losses. That suit is scheduled to go on trial in October in St. Louis. The dicamba debate is nothing new to Jim Wurstel, executive director of Arkansas-based Delta Land and Community Organization. He says eventually weeds will become dicamba resistant, and then there will be a new pesticide that will take its place with new challenges. He says all farmers need to get off what he calls the chemical treadmill and follow the lead of those who don't rely on pesticides.
And they've managed to control pigweed by crop rotations and mechanical means. And there are other means of controlling pigweed besides spraying with dicamba.
But that seems unlikely with so many farmers relying upon pesticides like dicamba on tens of millions of acres. Andrew Joyce says it would take a significant change at the federal level for him to consider planting again. And he's wondering where his customers will go for their squash, sweet potatoes, and green beans this summer.
You know, where's our all local produce going to come from? You know, it's not going to be grown here because you can't.
He says in the meantime, he's taken a job in town driving a forklift to make ends meet and will take his chances in court. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Up next, Main Street Eats.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we answer listener questions about the Constitution.
I made some suggestions about how we might amend the United States Constitution to make it more in keeping with a modern republic. Our listeners took seriously that essay, and they have responded with their own critiques of those amendments or their own suggestions about how we can fix the country.
One listener sent quite a detailed list about 3 amendments he'd like to see enacted, along with details on how it would work.
Jefferson wanted our system to be such that we can amend it, but it would be difficult to make amendments to the Constitution. So the genius of the system is to make it a high bar, but it also needs to be simple enough so that you can actually amend the Constitution from time to time. And the question we would ask our listeners is there a way to amend the existing Constitution to make it more in keeping with the aspirations of a 21st century people?
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we have Sue Belcom from the Rootseller Farm near Mandan with us for our weekly Main Street Eat segment.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
All right, February was really, really cold, and I'm just going to pretend that March is going to be 80 degrees all month.
Well, oh, keep pretending.
Okay, okay.
Yeah,
warming up
pretend.
Anyway.
Yep,
we can start thinking about good farmer's market and seasonal eating. And
what are you smoking?
the dispensary isn't open yet.
Because it is like, well, beautiful. You know, what is it, in like a lion, out like a lamb,
yeah,
or vice versa? I don't know. It looked, according to the weather, it's going to come in like a lion and leave like a lion. So, yes, I am so looking forward to spring. I can't even tell you.
Now, that lion sound is us roaring.
Well, and we don't have as much snow as you do on the eastern part of the state, but we still, like, my garden's under about 6 feet. So I'm looking forward to some sunshine and fresh vegetables,
yes,
farmers markets. And because we can't go to farmers markets right at the moment, we have to go back to our local grocers and our local food co-ops, of which we have more now in the state than we did 10 years ago. So I actually, after giving it some thought, decided to call the local Bisman Food Co-op and ask them what they were looking at for produce in the month of March. And they actually have some local growers, and I'm really excited about this because I imagine that you can find them at Prairie Roots also. One of them is from Streeter called Forager Farms, and they have microgreens. Oh. And we've talked about microgreens before. I have some growing in my house, but you're starting to find them on your shelves. So if you want to spruce up your smoothies or spice up your salads, I would suggest giving them a try. They're tiny little nutritious bites of goodness.
And they have a lot of flavor.
Yes, they do. You can get all kinds of different flavors, from pea shoots to sunflower seeds to spicy lettuce or radish. Those are my favorite. Purple radish sprouts are my favorite. I love those.
They are shockingly easy to grow and
they
fast.
They are. What did you ever do with all your excess microgreens?
I ate them all.
All right, good for you.
Well, root cellar, Sue, what's in your root cellar these days? Potatoes, I hope?
Yep. So there's potatoes, storage potatoes, and onions, and carrots that are available. But there's also somebody in Fullerton that's growing lettuce, so they source some locally grown winter lettuces.
Wow. Winter lettuce.
Yeah, which is kind of cool.
So is it a different kind of lettuce, or is it they have good hot boxes or cold boxes or whatever you call
greenhouses.
Greenhouses. Yep, I would say.
But they're special ones for this time of year.
Greenhouses and hydroponics, okay. I would say, are maybe two of the ways that we can get fresh lettuce. And, you know, lettuce is such a good thing to have. Because, you know, you can put things on top of it, like
yeah.
scrambled eggs or taco seasoned meat and things like that.
That's so, that 1,000
yeah,
calorie salad. Yeah,
Cobb salad's my favorite. Bacon. Don't forget the bacon.
Amen.
So regionally, there's a lot of grocery stores that source regional produce. And as you know, we do live in the Great White North. So we're talking about things that are probably storage items, like the carrots and potatoes and things, which you can easily find year-round in the grocery stores. But domestically, our coastlines, which are warmer, are coming up with some citrus fruits this time of year. And also, you're going to be able to probably find Bartlett pears in the grocery stores. Those are coming from South America, and they'll be in grocery stores in March. And, of course, avocados from Mexico. You're always going to get avocados at least through when the summer starts breaking here, I think. And usually these pieces of produce that are in season and other parts of the country and can be shipped up here are always the ones that you're going to find on your sale flyers at the grocery stores.
Pretty much everything's available now, isn't it? Because it's all grown everywhere.
Right. And they do ship everywhere. You know, it comes in all, from all over the world, which is one of the advantages of living in today's age as opposed to back in the day when when winter set in and you couldn't even get to the store, much less find an orange.
That's when you had to have that root cellar.
That's exactly right.
I remember being on a flight to Iceland once, and in the literature on the plane, it said that fruit wasn't common before World War II.
Well,
like, they got it once a year, like at Christmas.
Right. And I think that that explains the popularity of dried plums or prunes that they used for baking, dates and things. You know, they got dried fruits because those could be easily stored.
Sure.
And shipped by Pony Express or whatever. However, the mailman got to their house when the snow was 7 feet tall and nobody's blading the roads, I don't know. But yes, we can get things year-round pretty much. But when you really want to be a smart shopper, you want to do two things. You want to stay around the perimeter of the store because that's where your better, fresher food is.
A good tip.
And you want to also look for those sale items. I saw that blueberries were on sale this past week, and so they are coming in from some other part of the country. But they must have an abundance of them because that's why you're seeing them on the shelves. Certain types of apples are on sale right now. Not all of them. Like my Honeycrisp, they never really get down in price. But
yeah.
Now that I don't have kids at home, we sometimes don't care if things are on sale or not. We just buy them for ourselves. It's awesome.
But that's a great tip you're giving people, because in the bigger cities around North Dakota, you might get two food flyers in a Sunday paper, you know, one from one supermarket, one from the other, and they probably have the sort of the same things on sale.
Right. And that is basically because when they're in season, well, you guys, everybody knows how it goes. Like, it's feast or famine in the garden. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you're watching those tomato plants, and you're watching those tomato plants. You get that one tomato off of it one week, and you're like, yeah, $5. I'd pay $5 for that tomato. And in a week from that day, you can't give them away because they're so abundant. So, but if you look, you want to read labels on your produce, kind of read where it comes from and educate yourself a little bit about, you know, where it comes from. Some of the other countries don't have the same sorts of rules and regulations in place when it comes to fruits and vegetables. So just kind of like be aware. And if you can purchase these things a little local and not maybe treat yourself so often to something exotic, you'll be doing yourself a favor and you'll be supporting a local business.
And of course, you'll remember during those farmers markets in the height of summer how much better those tomatoes taste.
Oh, yummy, yummy, yummy.
We check in with our food maven, Sue Balcom, once a week.
Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thank you guys. Stay warm.
What's happening is next.
Next time on The Pulse,
this is our wilderness here. We can actually
spend time in the wild.
Wildness might be a peregrine falcon perched on a wolf tree in the middle of a pasture.
I'm over here every morning.
But does real wilderness still exist?
On every single research expedition, the first thing we find is trash.
It doesn't mean that there's no people.
Exploring wilderness on The Pulse.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Every Thursday, we try to answer that question right here on Main Street. And Christine McClellan of Prairie Public joins me today to look at our calendar of things to do. What's happening,
yes,
Christine?
Yes, what's happening? So there's a pancake feed hosted by Cub Scout Pack 201. This is going to be Saturday, March 9th at the El Zagel Shrine in Fargo. The Cub Scouts will serve buttermilk and blueberry pancakes with optional toppings, sausage patties, milk, orange juice, and coffee. So this starts at 8 a.m., goes until 1 p.m., and it is $7 to attend, but if you bring a non-perishable food donation, you can receive $1 off per person.
Stand-up comedy with Tom Papa is coming to Fargo and Bismarck. It's Friday in Fargo, Saturday in Bismarck. The Fargo Theater is the Fargo location, the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck. Tom Papa was on our show Tuesday, and he's bringing his stand-up comedy act to North Dakota. Papa is the head writer for Live From Here with Chris Thiele, and he performs a regular segment titled Out in America. The show starts at 8 o'clock. The cost is $29.50.
Celebrating 100 years of North Dakota women in municipal government. This is going to be at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck on Sunday, March 10th, led by historian Dr. Barbara Handy Marcello, and a panel discussion with Bismarck City Commissioner Nancy Guy, Burley County Commissioner Kathleen Jones, Mandan School Board member Marnie Peel, and attorney Greg Stites. The panel discussion will include actions to encourage women to serve on municipal boards. So this begins at 2 p.m. Again, that's on Sunday, March 10th, and it's free to attend.
India Night is Thursday. That's tonight. Grand Forks is the location at the UND Memorial Union Ballroom. Have you ever wanted to know or learn more about Indian culture? You can join the UND Student Association of India, learn and celebrate Indian culture, dance, and enjoy some East Indian cuisine. The doors open at 6 o'clock. The cost is free, so take it in. India Night at the UND Memorial Union Ballroom tonight.
The Beer versus Wine Smackdown 2019 is going to be at Abovo in Fargo on Friday, March 8th. Help decide the age-old debate of what pairs better with cheese, wine, or beer. Six cheeses will be paired with beer and wine, and you will be the judge. The pairings will be put in the ring, and the crowd will vote on every pairing to determine the beverage that will be crowned the winner. Each ticket is $48, and that includes six beers, six wines, and six cheeses. And this starts at 6 p.m. and goes until 9.
The Minot Legislative Forum is Saturday in Minot, of course, at the North Dakota State Fair Center's Norse Room. This is an opportunity for the public to hear from area lawmakers during the legislative session. The forum will feature the 12 Minot area legislators, and there will be written audience questions to be submitted to the legislators. It runs from 9 in the morning on Saturday until 11 a.m., and it's free. So take in the Minot Legislative Forum at the North Dakota State Fair Center's Norse Room.
Prairie Paws Rescue is hosting a meet and greet at the Jamestown Tractor Supply Company in Jamestown on Saturday, March 9th. Meet the pets available for adoption from Prairie Paws Rescue. These are pets that have been abandoned from puppy mills, owner surrenders, strays, and from area pounds. So this runs from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Again, that's at the Jamestown Tractor Supply Company.
Wine, cheesecake, and dueling pianos. That's Saturday in Dickinson at the Ramada Grand Dakota Hotel. You can enjoy music, wine, and cheesecake. The Domestic Violence and Rape Crisis Center of Dickinson is bringing the Fun Pianos, Dueling Pianos show back to town. The fundraiser will help victims of human trafficking, sexual assault, and domestic violence. Tickets can be purchased from the Chamber of Commerce. It runs from 7 till 11 on Saturday evening. The cost is $60. Again, this is in Dickinson at the Ramada Grand Dakota Hotel.
There's going to be robotic fun at the Becker County Museum in Detroit Lakes on Saturday, March 9th. Children and parents are invited to have some fun with robots. You can learn how computer coding works and then get a chance to actually apply it with a real robot. And you can also learn about 3D printing and watch a 3D printer hard at work. So this begins at 10 a.m., goes until noon on Saturday, and it's free to attend.
Well, here's some more fun for parents and kids. It's the Parent and Me Paint Date Saturday in Watford City at the Rough Rider Center. It's a creative afternoon for parents and kids. You can have fun with your child and paint together. Juice and snacks will be provided. The Parent and Me Paint Date starts at 4 in the afternoon, again at the Rough Rider Center in Watford on Saturday, and the cost is $40.
An afternoon of great jazz with our own Scott Prebis and Jazz Friends. So this is going to be at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck on Sunday, March 10th. You can warm up a late winter Sunday with some cool jazz. This starts at 2 p.m. and it is free and open to the public.
And what's your pick this week?
My pick this week is the Celtic Festival. This is the annual Celtic Festival at the Yumpcombe Center in Moorhead. This is going to be Saturday, March 9th. You can celebrate rich culture of the seven Celtic nations featuring history, art, and tradition, taking the Celtic heritage with dancing, music, and authentic food. And kids and adults can learn about traditions of the Celtic nations through hands-on activities and table displays. So this begins at 10 a.m., goes until 4 p.m., and it's $3 to attend.
I bet they'll be serving a little bit of haggis.
I think so.
I have a little Celt in my background. Okay. Well, my pick is Rebecca Bender reading from Still. Of course, you heard her at the beginning of our show today. This takes place on Sunday in, of all places, Ashley, which, of course, is where there are those roots of her family and her ancestors. It takes place at the Wild Rose Bar and Cafe. The author of Still, a new book published by the North Dakota University Press, travels to the place where her Jewish forebears lived in the early 20th century. Rebecca will read from her biography and memoir, and bars and coffee will be served. That's a North Dakota tradition, I think. It starts at 2 o'clock again at the Wild Rose Bar and Cafe in Ashley, North Dakota. This is free and open to the public, and that is what's happening.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll be joined by author and former Grand Forks Herald editor Mike Jacobs. His new book is The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years. Mike Jacobs and the Bank of North Dakota, next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 7th. What began as a desperate late-night ride to warn of an attack ended poorly for a young military man in Dakota Territory. Sam Brown lost the use of his legs after a 15-hour, 150-mile ride one wintry night in 1866 near present-day Sisseton, South Dakota. Legend calls him Prairie Paul Revere. He was born on this date in 1845 and raised on the Minnesota frontier. His father was a fur trader and a scout, and a major under General Henry Hastings Sibley. Brown also had Sisseton Sioux heritage through his mother, Susan Frenair. By the time he was 21, Brown had been involved in the Dakota conflict of 1862. He was captured by Santee Sioux in Minnesota and later recovered by Sibley's troops. His father was appointed special agent to Fort Rice on the Missouri River, south of present-day Bismarck. And Sam was made Chief of Scouts, based out of Fort Wadsworth, near what is now Sisseton, South Dakota, And this is where the legend begins. A scout told Sam about fresh tracks east of the James River near present-day Jamestown. They assumed they were from Native Americans intent on attacking white settlers. Brown sent a note to the commander at nearby Fort Abercrombie on the Dakota side of the river and lit out at dusk on horseback to warn scouts tenting near present-day Ordway, South Dakota. He covered 55 miles in 5 hours, but upon arrival, he was told the tracks were related to a call for a peace council at Fort Rice. Brown headed out again to intercept his dispatch to Fort Abercrombie to avoid a false alarm. He rode through high winds, freezing rain, hail, and snow, crossing rivers where he twice spilled from his horse on thin ice. He reached Fort Wadsworth in the face of the storm and collapsed in his cabin, but was able to speak to the commanding officer about correcting his message. Sam Brown never recovered from the ride. He was disabled for life and never walked again. He became a figure of local history in Browns Valley, Minnesota, and died in 1925 at the age of 80. The ride of Prairie Paul Revere came 91 years and one day after the storied Midnight Ride of Paul Revere during the Revolutionary War. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, are certain phrases keeping voters away from the ballot box?
It makes people think, fraud over here, suppression over there, it's all a mess. Why do I want anything to do with any of it?
Also, an Alabama pastor tries to heal his tornado-torn town.
How do I give a family that is grieving and angry? How do I give them hope?
Hear the news and the stories you'll talk about all day on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Friday on Main Street, at least some of agriculture's success in North Dakota can be credited to its state-owned bank. Mike Jacobs picked its centennial year to write the Bank of North Dakota from surviving to thriving. We'll share a Prairie Pulse excerpt. News director Dave Thompson will give us our Friday review of the week's big stories, and Matt Olin will review another new movie, Everybody Knows. Join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.